Before we get to the episode this week, we want to take a moment to address the June 24th Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. We talked about it in a bonus episode last month, and we'll definitely be talking about it in future episodes too.
Abortion is a basic healthcare need for the millions of people who can become pregnant. Everyone should have the freedom to decide what's best for themselves and their families, including when it comes to ending a pregnancy. This Supreme Court decision has dire consequences for individual health and safety and could have harsh repercussions for other landmark decisions.
If you or someone you know needs help, or if you want to get more involved through donating, volunteering, or protesting, or if you just want more information, please go to choice.crd.co. That's choice.crd.co. We encourage you to speak up, take care, and spread the word.
Nobody has more respect for women than I do. Nobody.
Hillary Clinton wants to abolish it, believe me. She wants to abolish our Second Amendment.
I think they didn't deny it. I don't think anybody denied it.
Other presidents did not call. They'd write letters, and some presidents didn't do anything.
Many people have come out and said, I'm right.
You really do have to ask yourself, where does it stop?
Hello and welcome to Fallacious Trump, the podcast where we use the insane ramblings of a man who exudes some real small dick energy to explain logical fallacies. I'm your host, Jim.
And I'm your other host, Mark. A logical fallacy is an error in reasoning that results in bad or invalid arguments. And the logical fallacy we're looking at this week is subverted support, which is like something that Trump would wear.
Subverted support is when, instead of focusing on whether an argument or a claim is valid or true, you focus on the reasons that a thing is happening.
Right.
So, for example, you might focus on how aliens get here without ever really showing that aliens have ever got here.
Right. Right. I'm immediately struck by the couple of books I have in my bookshelves, the Eric von Daniken, Were the Pyramids Built by Aliens?
Things aliens did when they were here.
Does God exist? Yeah, all that. Yes, yes. What aliens did. And someone at the back puts a hand up and go,
hang on.
Where are they then? Can you point to them? Yeah, I've missed them.
Yeah, it is missing a vital step in even making the claim, really, in the first place.
Right.
It's basically a form of begging the question, because in order for any of the stuff that you're saying to be valid, you're assuming the conclusion, essentially. You're assuming this thing is true, we don't need to discuss that.
Yeah.
Here's the detail.
Here's the detail. here's all the stuff about it. So you're focusing on all the attendant stuff rather than the person going, wait a minute, is what you're saying then this? Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
So our first Trump example comes from a rally where he was talking about critical race theory.
Getting critical race theory out of our schools is not just a matter of values. It's also a matter of national survival. We have no choice. The fate of any nation ultimately depends upon the willingness of its citizens to lay down, and they must do this, lay down their very lives to defend their country. If we allow the Marxists and communists and socialists to teach our children to hate America, there will be no one left to defend our flag or to protect our great country or its freedom.
By focusing on how important it is that we get critical race theory out of schools, he conveniently ignores the fact that there isn't critical race theory in schools.
Yes. Yeah,
he doesn't. He therefore doesn't need to address that aspect of it, or kind of offer any evidence for it existing or anything like that.
Yeah.
But by just focusing on it's vitally important to the point where we must fight to the death.
Yeah,
and people must do it to get it out of schools.
It's not just an expectation, but you have to do it. You must do it.
In fact, to be fair, it's been reported this speech a lot as Trump claims people must fight to the death to get critical race theory out of schools, and I kind of just did it. But really, in context, if you listen to it, what he's saying is, if we have critical race theory, then the Marxists and communists who teach our children will teach them to hate our country, and then the people who hate our country won't fight for it.
Yeah,
and we have to, you know, to have a valid country, we have to have people who will fight for it. So we can't let that happen, in a way. So he's not it's not quite, it's implied in a way that, that that's what we've got to fight for with our lives.
It's almost a second assertion, isn't it?
Yeah.
That he's not having to bother about making. He's just assuming that everybody knows that. Everyone knows you have to lay down your life for the country in the face of Marxist teaching people to hate the country, so that should push come to shove, nobody will lay down their life in front of the flag. It's a very rhetorical device, isn't it? That he's kind of skipped over the trigger, as it were.
Yeah, the inconvenience of showing that a thing really exists.
Yeah, he'd gone past that bit and gone straight to the bit that will stir up the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
He's missed past, the slight inconvenience of having to actually have something that actually exists as the problem that you're talking about. He's gone over that and he's gone straight to rabble-rousing. That's...
And speaking of things that don't exist, here he is talking about election fraud in 2020. Right.
The mail-in voting scam is the latest part of their four-year effort to overturn the results of the 2016 election. And it's been like living in hell. Our opponents have proven many times, again and again, that they will say and do anything to get back into power. The corrupt forces who are registering dead voters and stuffing ballot boxes are the same people who have perpetrated one phony and fraudulent hoax after another.
It has been like living in hell since he was elected in 2016, but not for the reasons he thinks.
That's right, yeah.
But essentially, first of all, he's arguing in a way that people were trying to overturn the results of the 2016 election. He made this claim repeatedly during the Russia investigation, which was never in any way either possible or what it was about.
No.
Because had everything about Russia been proved to everyone's satisfaction to the point where he had been impeached successfully, convicted and prosecuted and whatever.
Yeah.
Pence would have just got in as president.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't have overturned the results of the election.
No.
He just
wouldn't have
been
president. As far as the Republicans won. Yeah.
But that's how he saw it, was they were trying to overturn the 2016 election, and their method of doing that included registering dead voters and all of that kind of stuff, none of which happened.
No.
And presupposes that there was this massive fraud.
And those examples of that actually happening have been perpetrated by the Republicans.
Yeah, by Republicans,
yeah.
In pretty much every case we've seen. So,
exactly.
Yeah, and I mean, essentially, this is the entire thing of what the 2000 Mules documentary does.
Yeah.
Is it tells you how the fraud was perpetrated. It doesn't even do that. But it purports to do that, all the while ignoring the need to prove that it actually happened.
That
there was fraud.
Yeah.
And now is the time, I think, for Marx British politics. Corner.
In the news this last fortnight or so, Boris has gone to Rwanda to try and escape media scrutiny, but he was followed by Channel 4's Krishnan Gurumurthy, who we've come across before, who he was the interviewer that Gove said people have had enough of experts too. So he's quite a sharp kind of interviewer. He doesn't fall in with the bullshit. And I realised that Boris uses this fallacy, this, I want to call it perverted support, but it's this subversive support fallacy, because what he tries to do by telling you how he's fixing stuff, how he's addressing the problem, he asserts what the problem is. And in doing so, he's actually gaslighting the entire country into believing that the problem that they think are going on aren't the problem at all. So what he will do is say, yeah, we're doing this, we're working, and his well-worn phrase is, we're getting the job done, we're doing the job of government, we're getting the work done to combat these issues, and this is how we're doing it. And from that, you have to extrapolate. Well, wait a minute. So what are you saying the issues are? And in this case, he's trying to get Krishnan to accept the assertion that what's wrong with the country is the need for energy and transport reform.
You're on the right track to lose the next election catastrophically right now. I mean, the country is facing this massive economic crisis. We've got three strikes this week, and the people are saying, what on earth is the government doing?
Well, I'll tell you. So, on reforming the energy markets, we're getting on with that. You need to have much more supply. We need to rectify the gross mistakes of previous Labour governments that didn't invest in nuclear. We're building a nuclear reactor every year.
But all your political bandwidth is taken up with the European Court of Human Rights, with breaking the law on the Northern Ireland Protocol, with privatising Channel 4, all this stuff that doesn't matter to most people. I mean, these things are not priorities.
This is what you want to talk about.
When there's an economic crisis.
Sorry, this is what you want to talk
about. No, it's what you're doing. It's what you spend all your time talking about.
Let me tell you, on the contrary, I'm talking about what we're doing to reform the energy markets
we're not talking about energy markets right now. We'll do that another time. I mean, this is a bigger picture question, which is whether you can carry on leading the Conservative Party, because you were a winner and now you're losing catastrophically. You've had three terrible by-election losses. And your colleagues are saying it's time to get rid of him.
That's the main issue, is he's lost the by-election. But he's skipping over that and saying, and he's also skipping over the fact that there's, you know, a massive cost of living crisis currently in the UK, probably in the US as well, but most of Europe. And we have transportation strikes going on. And the government aren't doing anything about it. He actually says to me, what are you doing about it? He said, well, I'll tell you what we're doing. What we need to do is bring about some reform.
Yeah, it's about Labour not having invested in nuclear.
Yeah, yeah,
when
yeah.
was Labour last in?
Yes, 12 years ago. Yeah, that's right. You think, okay, so, all right.
It doesn't feel like that's what people are worried about right now.
That's right. Nor are these things that he's saying he's going to bring about the reform in, nor are they the things that they're actually, like Krishnan says, yes, your political bandwidth is taken up with. He also talks about culture wars and sowing division and privatising Channel 4, you know, spoiler alert, it's already private, and the breaking the Northern Ireland Protocol and arguing that the European Court of Human Rights is to blame for the refugee crisis. All of that stuff. So that's the noise.
Bloody human rights.
Yeah. Bloody human rights. Coming over here, giving people rights as if they're thinking they're humans. Yeah. So there are three things going on. There's the stuff that's really troubling people. There's the noise that they're making about all the culture war stuff, which is Channel 4, human rights, Northern Ireland Protocol. And then there's the things that Boris says they're addressing. And those things are because Labour's to blame. So it's no wonder they want to privatise Channel 4 and effectively shut it down, because Krishnan Gurumurthy is the only journalist to say to them to stop them. At one point in that interview, Boris said, look, I'm talking to you exclusively about these things. Like you're supposed to roll over and go, oh, we've got an exclusive. You know, but it's the same bullshit that we get from Boris when he gets challenged on just delivering the press release as an exclusive or otherwise. He then says, no, that's what you want to talk about, not what the people want to talk about. And for the people, read what I want to talk about.
Yeah. Which the thing is, when as a politician or any kind of celebrity, frankly, you go on an interview show, what the interviewer wants to talk about is how that works.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They get to ask questions.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Well, that's what you want to talk about. Well, yeah, because this is my interview. Yeah, no, well, and it just proves that Boris is extraordinarily uncomfortable in talking to anybody outside of the Yes Men or the Westminster Theatre of the Parliament. Okay, so this next example is Sky News' Kay Burley is trying to, I think what she's trying to do is generate support. She's effectively in the Boris Johnson seat at this point. So she is, although she's ostensibly the journalist.
Technically a journalist.
Technically Kay a journalist. Burley, yeah. insofar as She's in front of us.
She's on a a program with the word news in the
title. News in it. or employed by a company that called news, got news in the company name. Yeah. What she does is kind of reflect the press release. She's the media voice. That's why Boris was disappointed, I think. He's always disappointed about going on Channel 4. That's why he's disappointed by Krishnan Gurumurthy. And when he says, look, I've given you an exclusive on this, and all I want you to do is just to allow me to trot out what I've learned, the press release.
And that's what he gets on Sky News.
Yeah.
Why can't he have on Channel 4?
Yes, exactly. On Sky News, I'm allowed. I could just come on here and I could trot out a thing, and they go, okay, yeah, can you tell us what it is that you're doing to bring about these reforms? Yeah, rather than, well, why are you doing that? There's a hidden assertion here, Mr. Prime Minister, that these are the problems, when clearly they're bloody not, which is Krishnan Gurumurthy's stance. They're not the problems, and they're not even the ones that you talk about most of the time. So why are you doing it now? As Kay Burley just goes, yeah, the floor is yours. Tell us why you're so great, and tell us, you know, so I can continue to be paid. And so she's up against Mick Lynch, who is the head of the RMT union, the Rail Maritime Transport Workers Union, who are currently on strike, or they're currently in negotiations for better pay and better work conditions, because they're having changes imposed upon them by the companies that run the rail maintenance and the rolling stock currently in the UK. And Kay Burley, what she is trying to do is assert that, or she's skipping over the need to assert that striking and picketing are just bad. They're just bad things. What she's
inherently
problematic. Inherently, yes, problem. Because she's implying, because she says, you'll hear her, she says, you know, I'm older than I look. You know, and he kind of, actually, Mick Lynch is very polite.
To his credit, yeah.
He doesn't giggles at that point. He doesn't rise to the bait. And then she says, oh, well, it's the miners' strike. And what's great is he's standing outside Euston Station, and behind him, there are like six RMT workers in high-vis jackets. Members of the public walk up to them and shake their hands. That's that. Whilst he's on
camera.
It
couldn't possibly be a more peaceful demonstration.
She said, well, precisely what goes on? What is going on? Tell me what's going on. And he said, well, I don't. What are you implying with this line of questioning? Well, I don't know. I'm just asking questions. You know, and you think, oh. Yeah. And he steps to one side and kind of gestures. He said, well, you can see what's going on. that's what's going on. Well, it's not the miners' strike, is it? Look, that's what's going on. There's no policemen on horses thrashing the heads of striking miners week after week. You just go, we'll just ask people not to go to work and tell them why.
The government is saying that they are going to bring in agency workers. My question to you is, what will they do if agency workers try to cross those picket lines?
Well, we will picket them. What do you think we'll do? We run a picket line and we'll ask them not to go to work. Do you not know how a picket line works?
What do they do anyway? I very much know how a picket line works. I'm much older than I look, Mr. Lynch. What will picketing involve?
Picketing is standing outside the workplace to try and encourage people who want to go to work not to go to work. What else do you think it involves?
Well, I just wondered what else it might involve, because I very well remember the picket lines of the 1980s,
where are you going with your...
Mr. Lynch. I'm asking you what your members would do, Mr. Lynch.
Which picket lines are you talking about?
The miners' strike. Miners' strike.
Yeah? Well, does it look like the miners' strike? What are you talking about?
No, it doesn't, Mr. Lynch, but I'm just asking you what you expect your members to do.
But your questions are merging into the nonsense.
I'm asking you.
We will picket as effectively as we can.
And what does that involve?
There it is. That's what it involves.
So you won't stop agency workers crossing the picket line?
We will try to stop agency workers crossing the picket line by asking them not to go to work. What is it you're suggesting we will do?
I'm just trying to clarify exactly what your members
are trying to clarify? I've answered the question about six times. If there are people trying to cross the picket line,
not to my satisfaction, so I'm asking
we ask them not to cross it.
I'm asking, perhaps I could just ask it just once more, see how you feel about it. If agency workers want to cross the picket lines so that people can go about their work and their business and travel around the country, your members will ask them not to cross. If they continue to want to cross, then you will allow them to do so. Yes or no?
We won't allow them to do so. It's up to them whether they do so or not. We will ask them, under the laws of this land, not to cross the picket line and not to be strike breakers. But if agency workers think they can go into a signalling centre or operate a train, they're going to have a bit of a problem, aren't they? So what do you think these agency workers are going to do when they report and have crossed the picket line? They're not trained to do the work.
So she's implying that the picket lines are dangerous, frightful places where people get injured and battened by the police. But the thing she says will happen won't. And Mick Lynch, he just dismantles it by saying, pointing out that she's not giving us, she's not making the assertion that she's then providing the support for. So he just keeps going back. He's like, well, what are you implying? What is it? Where are you going with this line of questioning? He's literally asking her, what is it you're asserting in, and then you're trying to back me into the corner with, you're trying to associate me with?
I mean, the question that she's working extremely hard not to ask is, how violent are you prepared to get?
Yes, exactly. And then... And when he says, what are you implying? Well, this isn't the miners' strike. She just goes, Mr. Lynch, Mr. Lynch. And he goes,
if that's even your real name.
Yeah. And then she says, well, I'll ask it once more and see how you feel about it. Well, he's quite amused. He's not irritated or anything. He's not the irascible demon that Arthur Scargill was made out to be by the then Tory government in the 80s. He's a very pleasant, very lucid union representative. He's the perfect union rep because he talks in terms of this very reasonably. This is what my the work conditions that my members are currently working under. We haven't had a pay rise for 3 years. You're asking for a pay restraint, and we haven't had a pay rise for 3 years. And even Boris in Prime Minister's questions today, no, Wednesday last week, said that the taxpayers supported the transport system all through the pandemic, and they didn't. They weren't furloughed. They came into work. The transportation system continued to work throughout the pandemic because that's how hospital workers and essential workers, as they were termed, that's how they got to work. They were classed as essential workers. They had to go into work. They weren't subsidised by Rishi Sunak's furlough scheme. They went in, and now they're complaining that there's a massive loss. I think, in fact, Kay Burley says there's a massive loss on the transportation system, and he just goes, well, it's a massive loss because there was a pandemic and the government told everyone to stay at home. And so that's, she tries that. He just quite deftly dismantles her reasoning by asking her what you're implying. She asks him the question six times. He answers it six times. And then she says, you've not answered it to my satisfaction. What is it you're suggesting we will do?
Yeah, because he hasn't said, if an agency worker tries to cross the picket line, we'll bash their head
in
with
the face. That's right, yeah. We will tear him limb from limb.
That's the answer that would satisfy.
Blame the workers, blame the bosses. Yeah, as well, I'm sorry, but you haven't answered to my satisfaction. What you've not done is allow me, you've not given me the question I'm begging. Yeah, that's what she's complaining about, is that I want you to make the thing, to assert the thing that I'm implying, yes, without me having to do it. So that way she manages to stay an inverted commas impartial journalist.
Brisbane by-election, no Tory selection, Labour, Lib Dems and votes. Honiton and Wakefield, bit of insurrection, another senior colleague chokes. Chatting with the palace, get jobs for carry, letters from the leaders just go. Hiding in Rwanda, pretending he's a panda, grilled by Chris and no notes. The emperor is naked, no one can stand to fake it, the fat greasy goose is cooked. His popularity is waning, he's better keep feigning, everything's fine if you don't look. Always look dishevelled, nothing yet re-level, no Brexit benefit spied. Pretending to be mild, but a tantrum like a child, using fallacies in the wild. Reasons to be cheerful, part three. Reasons to be cheerful, part three. Reasons to be cheerful, part three. Reasons to be cheerful, one, two, three.
And during the blockheads here with Reasons to be Cheerful, part three.
And in the fallacy in a while, we like to talk about the fallacy of the week from a non-political perspective. And our first example this week, as it is sometimes, is from Friends.
Yay! In celebration of your Lego completion.
Yeah, yeah, I finished apartments. The Friends apartments.
That's so good, aren't they? Cool.
Yeah. So this is an episode where Phoebe thinks that a cat has been possessed by the spirit of her dead mum, Lily. And she's recently found and connected with her actual birth mum, played by Terry Garr, who's also called Phoebe, I think.
Perfect casting.
Yeah, brilliant. And he's kind of feeling a little bit guilty about the kind of that new relationship and it kind of maybe taking away from her relationship with her mum, Lily.
So, Phoebes, how long is your mum going to be with us?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I guess until she, you know, gets used to the fact that there's, you know, a new mom. Well, I think she's worried that she's gonna be replaced.
Well, that's not gonna happen, is it?
No. Okay, I have to return a call in the other room.
Why can't you use the phone in here?
Well, I'm returning a call from a certain mom at the BEACH. I just spelled the wrong word.
That's the other unspoken assertion that cats can't spell.
Absolutely. So, yeah, rather than make any attempt to prove that the cat is possessed by Lily's spirit, the point she is making is why it's happening and how and why she might then leave is when she gets used to the idea that that new Phoebe mum is about. And so it's all it's about the reasoning of why Lily has found her at this point and possessed this cat and what will stop it, rather than in any way kind of trying to show that it's real at all, which is what Ross has against it largely. So our second example in this section comes from Dr. Oz. Before he was a Pennsylvania political candidate, this was when he was, let's call it, a doctor.
Okay.
On TV.
A bit like Dr. Teeth. Is a doctor.
I mean, he's wearing scrubs in the clip. But I mean, this was long past the point where he'd ever actually kind of been practicing medicine in any real sense. He was just pushing quackery.
And we are embarking on this whole new a vista of opportunities. It broadens dramatically the spectrum of where we might be able to go in our bodies. And this is the area of energy medicine. And joining me today is Pamela Miles. Pamela's actually been to the operating room with me where we have done Reiki, and you're a Reiki master. My wife Lisa is Reiki master. So when the kids get sick, when I'm out of sorts, she actually comes by. I can't even tell when she's treating me. Sometimes she secretly treats me. She thinks I'm in a bad mood. And I see hands moving around, but I actually feel the heat. If you don't mind, maybe we can do some Reiki.
Certainly.
Have you had Reiki therapy before?
I have not.
Okay, so once you try it, as you're doing, if you don't mind explaining, Pamela, a little bit about Reiki.
Certainly. Reiki is a balancing practice. And so rather than addressing the headache or whatever else is the problem, what it does is it influences the person's overall system toward balance. And then as her system becomes more balanced, symptoms tend to fall away. Then over time, for example, if you get headaches, you know, you may find that you get them less frequently.
At no point do they actually say, Pamela, how does it work?
Does it work? Well, does it work is
does
the key.
It work?
Yeah. How does it work? What do you do is the question they ask instead of, does it work?
Yeah. Well, it doesn't even go.
It's implied.
It just says, tell me about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell me, talk around, use some words to describe this thing.
The implication with all of these things, when they are presenting alternative therapies on these shows, and Dr. Oz did it for years on the Oprah show and on his own show, and, I mean, he's just one of many people who do this. The implication is it works, and now we're going to talk about, you know, the benefits you get from it.
Like
all
what
of that
happens
stuff.
When we do it,
There isn't ever the question on these shows of does it work. It's always just assumed. And, I mean, in case it wasn't clear from that clip, if you haven't encountered Reiki before, it is what regular doctors like to call bullshit.
Yeah, well, and he kind of hints about that, even as an irregular doctor, as Dr. Oz is. He hints about that. He says, sometimes when I'm in a bad mood, I see some hands waving.
Yeah. I can't even tell she's...
I feel the heat. That could just be, you know, she's breathing down your neck, or you'll just...
She left the oven on or something.
Yeah. she's branding you with a fish slice that's been under the grill. Yeah,
It's not even the laying on of hands, this therapy, because there isn't... It's not involving touching. It's kind of waving your hands around someone. But my ex-sister-in-law was a Reiki master, is still presumably a Reiki master. And it is the biggest load of bullshit I've ever heard. It is to the point where it's kind of genius, because it is a therapy that people will pay for, and it can be done at a distance.
Yeah.
You can do it over the phone, over the internet. So
not even talking about it, they'll just do it. They'll just say, oh, yeah, I'll do that for you.
There's literally no way of showing that you have done anything at all.
No.
So you can just take money from people, say you've done it, and they cannot say, I don't believe you did anything.
Let's give up the podcasting thing. Just do Reiki. Why have we not thought about this before?
It's
something to do with our critical thinking.
Yeah.
With, you know, it's a betrayal of all
integrity, that bullshit.
As Dr. Oz says, it does allow us to explore other parts of our bodies.
Yes.
You know, and you kind of go, well, okay, yeah. Uh-huh. The bullshit areas.
Not the brain.
No. He said, yes, you have come into surgery with me and done Reiki. And that was the most frightening bit. What?
Yeah.
That's right. For the surgery, I don't know what's up. Why have you bothered even going in? Why did you stand outside? Why did you just phone it in? Yeah. Don't go into the flipping operating theatre. Yes, I want people wielding bits of steel, you know, cold, sharp blades. Yeah. Don't want people who come in and go... It's about rebalancing.
People who believe in the germ theory of disease, rather than that you get energy blockages because of negative thoughts.
Yeah.
And that somehow waving your arms around can release that and make you move your system to more overall balance.
Yeah.
So we're gonna play
fake news, folks. I love the game, it's a great game.
I understand the game as well as anybody. As well as anybody.
Yes, it's time for Fake News, the game where I read out three Trump quotes, two of which are real and one I made up, and Mark has to figure out which one is fake news.
You see, so magnanimous as I am in my continued victory in playing this game, I'm going to explain, because it's something that Wilhelm Reich taught me. It's called Ayurvedic message transference. It's an ancient autonomic genetic predilection that my species has for success.
Right.
And that's how
you've managed to win so much.
I've managed to win.
Right.
Constantly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Trump put out a 12-page statement in response to the January 6th committee hearings. These are not from that statement, because I looked at it thinking, oh, this is going to be gold. But but there's literally no chance Trump wrote that.
No.
It contained some coherent thoughts.
Right. And knowing as we did from from Bob Woodward's book, that he was talked out of doing anything other than making a written statement because they could write it for him.
Yeah. So I looked at that and then dismissed it, because it's just too coherent.
Yeah.
So these
yeah.
are instead from a speech he gave at the Faith and Freedom Coalition conference, where he talked to all of the kind of conservative evangelical Christians in the room. About, in part, the January 6th committee. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit responding to the stuff that he was accused of, which we will talk about anon.
Yes.
Statement number one. CNN yesterday, did you see what happened? They came out with a strong statement that they are prohibited, totally prohibited, from using the term the big lie. They're not allowed to use it anymore. You know why? Because they know that the big lie is actually the big lie in reverse, and they have great liability and they don't want to use it, but they came down with an edict.
Mm.
Statement number two. It's like the Russia hoax. Russia, Russia, Russia. In fact, if you want the truth, it's worse than the Russia hoax. And Shifty Schiff is in this one as well. Remember, he totally made up a call I made. It was a perfect call and he lied about it. Well, now he's lying about great people like Jim Jordan. He totally fabricated a tweet. But that's what these people do. They're corrupt, sick, evil people.
Okay. Shifty Schiff makes a reappearance.
Statement three.
Mm-hmm.
The Unselects. So I call them the Unselect, and they act like, oh, they never mention it. I think it's one of the great... They'd never mention it. Someday they'll give me credit for that term. I had a lot of good terms. We had a lot of good nicknames, didn't we? Didn't we have great nicknames? I think it's one of the best. I don't know. It's not catching on because they won't let it catch on.
Oh, there you go. That's it. Yeah, yeah. You see, there's no news on the internet about contrails because they won't let them put it on there. Yeah. Okay, well, I was quite taken with that one as being real because it's got his usual changes of thought. It's one of the great... They never mentioned it. Someday they give it credit for that. And then a lot of good nicknames is putting me off. And then Shifty Shift. Perfect call. Okay. The big lie, actually big lie in reverse. As I always call it, the big lie in reverse. that common term. As the saying goes, their great liability. That sounds very Trump-like as opposed to Jim-like, which also sound very Trump-like. I'm a little bit suspicious of their good nicknames. Okay, despite my suspicions... Oh, dear. I'm going to go for... Oh, no. I'm going to regret whichever... Shifty Shift. Okay. All right. Yeah, I'm going to go for that. Okay. I think number two is the one that you made up.
Okay. So, of the other two, which are you more convinced by?
More convinced by the CNN, the big line reverse.
Okay. So, number one.
Yeah.
Is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Real.
CNN yesterday, did you see what happened? They came out with a strong statement that they are prohibited, totally prohibited, from using the term the big lie. They are not allowed to use it anymore. You know why? Because they know that the big lie is actually the big lie in reverse. And they have great liability. And they don't want to use it, but they came down with an edict.
Is it needless to say that they don't... That isn't true?
Oh, yeah, that's completely false, yeah.
Yeah.
No, that, yeah.
The big lie is this big lie about their... Big lie.
No, I mean, this is a small lie about the big about them.
Yeah, about the big lie.
About the big lie. Yeah. No. Yeah. There's a new president of CNN, Chris Licht, and he did, in a staff meeting, say that his preference would be that they avoided using the term the big lie.
Mm-hmm.
He made it very clear in the meeting that it was a preference, not a mandate.
Is it because he had a more of a preferred term?
Yeah.
His
problem with it was not that they know it's not really a big lie and they have liability about it at all. It was that the big lie, the term the big lie, is too associated with Hitler.
Right.
And as a news organisation, he thought,
let's
not invoke Hitler that much.
Yeah.
So his suggestions as alternatives were that they use the terms Trump election lie.
Right, yeah, fair enough.
Or election lies.
Yeah.
the problem, obviously, with those is that they don't narrow it down nearly enough.
Yeah.
Because we know what the big lie means. The big lie
The big lie.
There was massive election fraud in 2020.
Yeah.
But Trump has told many, many election lies.
Yeah. Yes. And just calling them the Trump election lies.
No, that doesn't narrow it down.
Narrow it down
hardly at all.
No, no. That's right. Yeah. Okay, amongst all the lies, the really big one, that one that's sticking up over there. Yeah, that one, the big lie, uh-huh. That's the one we don't want to talk about.
And
consequently,
CNN have continued to use the big lie ever since that meeting. They've still done it just as much as they ever were doing it. Because it has become a thing that people understand as talking about this election fraud
idea. And actually, the association with Hitler is probably...
It's not that bad. It's
been superseded, and it's only in the minds of historically aware social commentators that's troubling.
Yeah.
And Trump is neither aware, historical, nor a social commentator.
No.
So it doesn't give no.
If anything, it's making Hitler look worse.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah.
So.
And yeah.
I mean, no one's really going to complain about that now.
No, exactly. Yeah.
I
don't think anyone, I've heard anyone say Hitler would be turning in his grave. No. Time it's ever said.
You also think that number three is real.
Up until 7 minutes ago, I did, yes.
And
number three is real,
Is real.
Oh, what?
The Unselects. So I call them the Unselects, and they act like, they never mention it. I think it's one of the great, they never mention it. Someday they'll give me credit for that term. I had a lot of good terms. We had a lot of good nicknames, didn't we? Didn't we have great nicknames? I think this is one of the best. I don't know. It's not catching on because they won't let it catch on.
On my TikTok feed, there's this... it isn't the one that did Drunk Trump. Oh, it may well actually be. But there's this comedian, a woman, who does lip-syncing to irascible, male-centred... male comedians. And she does this kind of lip-syncing to it. And it highlights... both the comedy of the content and also the misogyny of the delivery. And it sounds exactly like that. It's Trump being the cruise ship comedian again, isn't it? They go, it's a great term, the Unselect. I call them the Unselect. Quite a good name for a band. It'd probably be a kind of ska revival band, wouldn't it? So I call them the Unselect. I think it's one of the great ones.
Why would they ever mention Oh, by the way, Trump calls us the Unselect Committee. What the...
Yeah.
In what universe would they ever bring it up?
Yeah, exactly. And why sufficient for somebody to say... Who came up with that term?
Yeah.
That's a brilliant term.
Yeah, because he's not getting credit for this thing that only he ever says. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Like he said, as the saying goes, and then comes up with the saying that nobody has ever made except him.
But he also thinks the reason this brilliant nickname...
they won't let it.
Which is just him adding on to who they are.
Yeah.
It's not catching
on.
Yeah,
because
they won't let it catch on. As if anyone has been able to avoid getting a nickname by just not letting it catch on.
Yeah, or deliberately going out of their way to kind of police it like Sony does YouTube. They're going to go, well, you see, if someone's going to start using a negative version of what we're called, then we're going to have to pursue that. As if we own the copyright. What is he talking about? I don't know.
Bizarre.
It's one of the best. It's one of the best.
He's
none of these nicknames.
His nicknames are all shit.
None of them.
This is not one of even the better ones.
One of the least shit ones. Didn't we have great nicknames? No. I think it's one of the best. Okay. It's not catching on because they won't let it.
Stop trying to make Unselects happen.
Yeah.
So number two. You correctly deduced was fake news. It's not it's not entirely dissimilar to stuff he has complained about.
Yeah.
About
kind of,
it's kind of
greatest hits,
yeah.
isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah. He plays the hits, yeah.
Yeah. Is Shifty Schiff involved in...
Shifty Schiff is in the January 6th committee, and Trump has claimed that Schiff fabricated a text or tampered with a text or something like that that Jim Jordan made. In fact, he quoted verbatim the text, but just left off like the last line or something, which did not in any way change the meaning of the text at all. It's just like, because he didn't read the whole thing or put the whole thing on the screen, that means that
he fabricated.
Because basically he added a period instead of an ellipsis because it was a comma in the original one. So therefore, it's a complete fabrication and changes, according to Trump, the meaning 100%.
Okay. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because
it's weird, isn't it?
The summary of the Mueller thing, Trump's representative kind of summarising him and let him off, despite the fact that, as many commentators pointed out, you just go, well, there's a semicolon at the end of that sentence.
Yeah.
Why have you stopped there? Why have you stopped there?
So that means you did get an addition to your score. Isn't it? You're now on 46 out of 93, which is almost 50%, but not quite.
Yeah.
Nearly there.
Yeah.
If you can make it, by the time you get... Well, if you... Yeah. It would be cool.
By the time we get to
100... By the time we get to 100, if you can be over 50, that would be... Yeah, you've still got plenty of time. Seven whole episodes to try and get over 50.
To merely get...
You only need four.
Points.
Yeah. Four right would give you 50. So, yeah.
Yeah. And then I've got to hold on to it. Yeah. How hard can it be? It's been impossible, pretty much. Well, as we can see, plainly, from the score...
Before we move on, I have a surprise announcement that Mark doesn't even know about.
Oh!
This episode is sponsored by our favourite podcast production tool, Zencastr.
Is it? How marvellous is that?
The reason I didn't tell Mark about this is that I wanted to get his genuine, unscripted, off-the-cuff feelings about Zencastr. So, Mark, how easy is Zencastr to use?
Well, it's impossibly seamless. You kind of log on... And up it pops. And actually, the new interface, because we've been using it for ages, the new interface is great because it just says, this is what you're using to speak through. This is what you're using to listen through. Here's what you look like on the screen. And the other bloke is already there. Click here and you're in.
Basically, it's an all-in-one VoIP chat and studio quality recording tool.
Yep.
You can record great audio or HD video with up to four guests. And... sometimes when you hear a podcaster advertising something on their show, you might wonder, well, yeah, but do they actually use it? Or are they just getting paid to say this?
We've used it forever.
Not only have we used it since our very first episode, we're using it literally right now to tell you this.
To tell you that we're using it. Yeah. When the pandemic happened, actually one of the first tools I started touting around was, we use Zencastr for podcasting. We could just use that. You just send a link where you go and record it and all of that kind of stuff.
And compared to some other tools that you could use for that kind of thing, it's built basically ground up for podcasting.
Yeah.
I consult on a few other podcasts for complete beginners, and I've always advised that they use Zencastr because it's just completely foolproof. And at the moment, Fallacious Trump listeners can get a 2-week free trial and then 30% off their pro plan for 3 months by going to zen.ai/fallacioustrump and using the promo code fallacioustrump.
Nice. There you go. You can start up your own podcast. There's nothing standing in your way now.
And it's time for the part of the show that this week, at least, is called Public Hearings Are Not a Logical Fallacy, because in between our last recording and now, there have been now 6 public hearings of the January 6th committee, which is the part of the process, having spent months and months working through depositions and gathering evidence and talking to all kinds of different people. This is the bit where they present it to the public and try and make it into a narrative that not only tells the American people, and people around the world, in fact, what went on January 6th and what led up to it. But also they're telling the Department of Justice, who have said that they're watching these hearings, they are making the case for prosecutions and for things to be taken further.
Just from a filmmaker's point of view, or even a online presentation point of view, it's perfect. It's delivered in a perfect way, in a very and the documentary style, if we can call it that, is very un-American. It's not narrative led. This stuff just gets played out, and then there's an explanation afterwards, and then there's a kind of introduction of the next speaker. And so they've had documentary filmmakers on there, they've had parliamentarians on there, they've had advisors and lawyers, and they're all it's slicker and more serious and actually is, more absorbing than the Amber Heard Johnny Depp.
It is made for TV. It is.
Yeah.
In fact, they hired James Goldston, who was the former head of ABC News, to produce the live broadcast.
Yeah.
And I do wonder whether he also had any kind of input into their structure, because they have very much kind of done each hearing has been on its own theme and kind of telling a discrete part of the story as if it is a dramatic series. It's been compelling. So the first one was kind of an overview. They have Liz Cheney has featured very heavily. She is the vice chair of the committee. Benny Thompson is the chair of the committee, and he's been doing kind of mostly the introductions. But the opening statements on several days have been left to Liz Cheney. And then they've had different members of the committee largely asking questions of the witnesses on each day. There's been Adam Kinzinger, Adam Schiff, Zoe Lofgren. I am absolutely sure Jamie Raskin will do one of the summing up days, because he's awesome. He was on the second impeachment, I think, team. He will do very well when he does. But they all so far have done a great job. Cheney, as much as we disagree with everything she stands for in terms of politics, she absolutely brought that home again when she came out saying essentially what a great result Roe v. Wade being overturned was. As much as she is an awful person, she's on the right side of history in this, and she is doing the right thing here.
Yeah, and in a way, actually, that is troubling for everyone on the right as well, because she's the kind of, to me, she kind of occurs as the equivalent of Liz Truss, kind of Liz Truss / Nadine Dorries here in the UK, who are hateful people who've got horrible right-wing agendas and narcissistic tendencies, but are the darlings of the right.
Yeah.
So for Liz Cheney to then be just kind of giving exegesis and a chapter and verse in a very straightforward way, and that what it does is remove any kind of accusations of the possible accusations of an agenda.
I mean, you'd like to think that. She's absolutely being called a rhino, despite the fact she voted with Trump basically 98% of the time. Kinzinger, both of their careers are probably over. He is, I think, retiring because he realises there's no chance he's going to get re-elected. She will be primaried. At the moment, I think she is trying in quite some vein to get Democrats to change affiliation to independent so they can vote for her in her primary.
Wow. Yeah.
I don't think is going to happen. She's going to probably lose her primary because, any Republican that is in Trump's thrall is very much is now against her.
Because she's a Judas. She's betrayed.
But this has been, what I would say is this hasn't been a bipartisan hearing because almost everyone who has given evidence has been Republican.
Yeah.
It has been unipartisan.
Yes.
In the sense that there haven't been Democrats saying how bad Trump was and how he definitely led to the attempted overthrow of the government. It's almost entirely been Republican witnesses, which is, I'm sure, a very conscious choice that they've made. A lot of the stuff that has come out has been stuff that, if you've been paying attention for the last 10 months, you will already know about.
Yeah.
But there has also been a lot that you definitely won't have known about, and no matter how much attention you're paying. There have been revelations each episode, each time, each hearing.
Yeah.
There's been foreshadowing, there's been throwing forward, there's been twists at the end. There's been kind of next time on the public hearings we'll be hearing about this.
Yeah.
So, it's very made for TV, but it's also very methodical, very prosecutorial, and full of video evidence, depositions, text evidence, and stuff directly linking the things they're trying to link, rather than implying links.
They are very
careful to say this happened because of this, and here's how we can show that. Here's everything that you need to see that what happened here led directly to January 6th. Just going to go through the kind of the six hearings and the kind of the main takeaways, basically. So the first one was kind of an overview of the stuff you're going to hear. There was the thrust of it really was what happened actually on the 6th with the Proud Boys, particularly at the Capitol. And we had footage of Bill Barr saying that all of the stuff that Trump was saying about the election fraud was BS. He said bullshit, and they kind of were very coy about using that term in the committee itself, but happy to play the clip multiple times during the hearings. And they also played a clip of Ivanka saying that, you know, she talked to Bill Barr and she respects him and she believed him when he said it was all bullshit. So that must have been a bit of a blow to Trump. And then, so the first half of that, of the first hearing, was pretty much some footage of depositions and Liz Cheney's kind of opening statement of the whole process of saying what these are the things, very prosecutorial again, these are the things we're going to show you over the course of these hearings. This is the narrative that we are going to present to you, and we will prove these things. The second half of the first hearing was witnesses, a documentary filmmaker, a British guy called Nick Quested, and Capitol Police Officer Caroline Edwards. Quested was making a documentary about the
Proud
election, the Proud Boys, all of that kind of stuff. And so we saw footage of the insurrection that had never been released before. Caroline Edwards was a Capitol Police officer who was kind of trying to hold the line, essentially, against the incoming crowd and the Proud Boys, and was injured a couple of times and continued to do what she could to protect the Capitol. She was quite inspirational, and it was an emotional testimony that she gave. I think she was a really good choice as a witness.
When you and I make documentaries, often you want one person to represent. So you're dealing with the stuff that I've made. You know, you're dealing with a phenomena of flooding or famine or disease or maternal child health issues, and it affects many hundreds, if not thousands, of people. But what you want is one representative to speak for them. And the key is to find the right representative, particularly if you're doing something to get donors to give you money or to get governments to see where you're spending your money or to get campaigners to campaign on your behalf or governments to bring about changes. You want somebody that's particularly affecting. So it's important to choose the right person. And with her, they did that.
Yeah.
Because it she was summarized she was really all good. Of that we've seen before and added something more.
So hearing number two, last Monday, I think, was focused largely on the big lie. Trump's claims and how much he tried to disseminate them, and how much he believed it to some extent as well. How much there was essentially everyone in his circle telling him he'd lost. Everyone except a clearly inebriated Rudy Giuliani, who was the one person on election day who was saying, just claim you've won. Just come out and say you've won and it'll be fine. And obviously, because Trump is a complete narcissist, the only person out of everyone who was saying you've probably won is the one he believed. All of the people with actual political experience and expertise who were saying it's not looking good, you know, you get ready to concede, he was like, oh no, they don't know what they're talking about. Drunk Rudy over here, he's the guy,
really knows
he's saying the things I want to hear.
That's right, yeah, he's not telling lies, he's not holding back. No. And of course Rudy, knowing that he's a narcissist, is thinking, right, if I tell him this, then there's probably going to be money in it.
But then
Rudy, not knowing Trump as we do, is he's never going to pay him that money.
So the witnesses for this one were the U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Georgia, B.J. Pack, former Philadelphia City Commissioner Al Schmidt, and election attorney Benjamin Ginsburg. And they were basically, in their testimony, just kind of arguing back, debunking the all of the claims that people were making about, you know, ballots being delivered in the middle of the night, about all of the crazy claims that were fought back against at every lawsuit that Trump lost in the months following the election. All of the claims that were being made by people like Giuliani and by Sidney Powell and people like that. And just kind of randoms, people who were posting things online. And as we've seen more recently, Trump was just picking up any bullshit theory anyone put on the internet. And he was like, oh, look into this. When we get to hearing five and he was talking to the DOJ, it seems like their job for several weeks at least after the election was just to chase down any nonsense thing he read on the internet.
But about the voting machines and then the routers and then the satellite.
Yeah, the Italian satellites. Oh,
Jesus God. Yeah. Jesus
God. So we heard in this one also depositions from Eric Hirschman, who was former White House attorney, who seems to like saying things in funny ways and then relaying how funny he was when he said them. Like when he told John Eastman, you know, I'm going to give you the best legal advice you've ever had free. Get a fucking good lawyer. You're going to need one, and stuff like that. So,
yeah,
he seemed unsympathetic towards Trump's claims, and was just saying basically all the time, no, this is bullshit. None of this is true. The stuff you want to do is illegal. And to some extent, part of what they were trying to do in these hearings was show that Trump knew that the stuff he was claiming was a lie, knew that the things he wanted Pence to do were illegal, and pressed ahead anyway, and therefore can be prosecuted essentially for obstruction of justice, you know, defrauding the US, and
perverting,
probably inciting a riot and all of that kind of stuff.
Because he was equipped with the best legal advice and Rudy Giuliani.
And his best defense, which he has claimed, is even though literally everyone I ever hired who knew what they were talking about told me it was false, I refuse to believe them. Therefore, I can't be held responsible.
Well, it's the same. It's the same Boris Johnson defense, isn't it? I didn't know it was a party. I was assured that everything was done within the rules. Even if it was a party, nobody told me that it was.
But nobody told me I wasn't allowed to have a party.
Nobody told me I wasn't. You were the one that made the fucking rules up. I wasn't there. It wasn't me.
Yeah, the Shaggy defence, basically.
Exactly. Yeah.
So hearing number three was about the pressure that was put on Mike Pence to subvert the real electors on January 6th and choose the fake slates of electors that had just been randos who had claimed to be electors and then put things forward on,
because they were
not even headed to paper, they just like fax something through saying we are electors honest.
Exactly. Aren't we? Misspelt. Yeah.
My mum says I'm an elector.
Yeah. Exactly. Signed by my mum. Yeah.
And the witnesses for this one were Greg Jacob, who was Mike Pence's chief counsel, and former federal judge Michael Luttig, who was the slowest speaker you've ever heard.
Well, he kind of tried to imbue it with some gravitas.
I think that's what he thought he was
being bloody. Ironside. No, not Ironside. Who was
Matlock? No.
he
claimed afterwards he was choosing his words extremely carefully, and I can understand that.
Yeah, I think he was just choosing them extremely slowly.
He was choosing them extremely slowly.
But they weren't. Yeah, when he got to the words, they weren't anything out of the ordinary.
Well, it was difficult. That's the thing. Is it was so slow and so halting and so weird that it was quite hard to remember how the sentence started when he finished it.
Yeah, yeah. I did have to watch a lot of it on 1.35 speed.
Cecil from the Cognitive Dissonance podcast put on... He's also a video guy, incidentally. And he edited out all the pauses and put that up on the Cognitive Dissonance YouTube channel. So
nice.
Check that out. Yep. If you watched the Luttig testimony and thought, what the fuck was that about? I couldn't take it in. Which, I've
aged tremendously.
Having watched the version on the Cognitive Dissonance YouTube channel, it made a lot more sense. I got a lot more out of it and I understood what he was saying.
Right.
There were significant parts during Luttig's actual live testimony that I was like, apart from losing the will to live, genuinely losing the thread of what he was trying to say. And he was to some extent going around in circles. I mean, he's a retired judge. He's kind of trying very hard to make sure that he words things correctly without any ambiguity. Yeah. In the same way, as I said, we claimed that Mueller was doing when Republicans were claiming that Mueller had a stroke or had a speech impediment or something like that, and he was senile because he wasn't speaking properly. And we who watched that were saying what he's doing is trying not to give a soundbite that can be used to say something that is the opposite of what he's trying to say.
Yeah.
He's trying to choose his words carefully so that he doesn't need to then clarify them later. And I think, honestly, that is probably what Luttig was trying to do. It came across very weirdly. Yeah. But the points that he was making and the points that Greg Jacob was making were largely the same, which is that Pence just did not have the legal precedent or legal ability to do what was being asked of him by John Eastman and by Cheesebro, who came up in this particular hearing. Yeah. And both of them were very clear on that. And as it turns out, so was John Eastman by the time it came around to January 6th. He knew that full well.
Yeah.
We also saw the deposition of Eastman, or we saw a bit of it because there's no point watching much of it because he just pled the fifth over 100 times.
He said the word fifth.
That's all. After you've said it initially, you just say fifth, and that's fine.
Oh, I would have made him say it every single time, just to piss him off.
I would have asked questions that could potentially have been answered with the word fifth.
Fifth,
in a kind of two Ronnies mastermind sketch type thing.
Exactly. Yeah. What's the measure? The standard measurement of one shot of whiskey in a UK pub. Fifth.
But they didn't do that as far as we saw, at least. They may have done it and just not showed that clip. But what they did show was an email from Eastman when he said, I've decided I should be on the pardon list if that is still in the works,
yeah.
Which is fun.
Which is kind of going, well, seeing as you've asked so nicely, yeah. I've decided. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Now,
by the authority invested in me by my own particular narcissism, I've decided.
Now, the thing about pardons, this is something I will be asking Andrew Torres if I ever get actually to speak to him, is when you plead the Fifth, then it's not allowed for the court to assume that there's any guilt implied by that. Even though, essentially, you are saying, I refuse to answer on the grounds I may incriminate myself.
Yes, yes.
That very much implies there's something to incriminate. But it is not allowed to assume guilt based on that.
Yeah.
With pardons, if a pardon is offered to you and you accept it, the courts, the precedent says that implies guilt. That is... an implicit acceptance of guilt if you accept a pardon.
Yeah, and also there's an assumption that you're guilty of something. Otherwise, what are you asking to be pardoned?
Well, that's my question, because there is implicit, there is legally based implicit guilt if you accept a pardon. I don't know if you're allowed to assume someone is guilty of something if they ask for a pardon.
Yeah,
because presumably, if they're asking for a pardon, if it was offered, they would accept it, thereby implying guilt.
Yeah.
But I don't know if there's case law that says if you ask for a pardon, you're basically confessing to a crime.
Yes, exactly. I can see that there's the implication there. So, otherwise, if you've nothing to be pardoned for, I mean, you don't say, I beg your pardon if you don't burp. In polite company. So why would you beg for a pardon if you've not done anything that requires a pardon?
And Eastman is far from the only person in these hearings who we will hear has asked for a pardon.
It's a rogue's gallery, isn't it? There's some familiar faces on there.
Well, in the first hearing, we heard that Representative Scott Perry asked for a pardon. Representative Scott Perry and other Republicans. And that was just to kind of tease for what we would hear later.
Because you immediately want to go,
what have
they done? That's right, Who are they and what have they done? And you go, I mean, it's perfect. It's perfect telegram of teleprogramming, isn't it? Yeah, keep watching, because we'll find out.
And I think the hearings have got kind of progressively better and more interesting since, from probably third one on at least, because the fourth one was about the pressure that was put on state officials and election workers to make whatever attempts they could to overturn the election.
Yeah, so, I quite liked it because it went from Pence, who we kind of don't really care about, but the intrigue surrounding that, and most intriguing of all was John Eastman, who kind of just pled the Fifth on. So were you involved in the thing that said that who got to hear that Pence could do this in the first place? Nope, can't do anything. But then to kind of spread it out to ordinary, normal people that were doing their job at the various counts and the impact that it has had on them because they were hounded by idiots.
Yeah.
Who, you know, and death threats and all that kind of stuff. So again, it was nice casting. In a way, you know, in your, I guess you can talk about that in documentary terms. When you cast somebody, well, we got Mike Pence, who is we know about him. Nobody really cares about him. But what we're interested in is the people that were behind the inference that he could do something about it. That's the interesting bit there. But then to have these election workers, just anonymous election workers. Who are just doing it as a job. That's what they do. And then they come in for this extraordinary abuse and life-threatening abuse.
I mean, first of all, we got testimony from Rusty Bowers, the Speaker of the Arizona House of Representatives, Republican Speaker again. The other one was Brad Raffensperger, the Georgia Secretary of State. they talked about all of the calls that they had had with Trump, where he was just trying to get them to say that there had been massive fraud with no evidence.
Just say it 11,000 times. It'll be fine.
Yeah, we know about the call with Raffensperger where he was saying, you know, I only need 11,000 votes. Even though he was claiming, and this is something, again, that the opening arguments guys say, this is kind of one of the most slam dunk, definitely he committed a crime. This is, we have the evidence, we have the intent, we have everything, because it is a crime to ask someone to put down an incorrect number. And he was specifically saying, at the same time he was saying, I won by hundreds of thousands of votes, he, in the same phone call, he was saying, put down, you know, fine me 11,000 votes. 11,700 votes, whatever. And that in itself, just during the course of that phone call, is a prosecutable crime. So, and they are working on that, apparently, in Georgia. So
nice. I'm just given pause there for a moment, but the fact that none of this is anything from either of the impeachments.
Yeah, no, absolutely. This is other crimes.
Oh my god.
He fitted a lot in.
Rusty Bowers
was a great witness, again, largely because not only is he a Republican, he still, despite all of this stuff, says he'll vote for Trump again if he gets the nomination. So he's still a Trump supporter.
Yeah.
And yet, he, due to the pressure that he was under, people with guns were coming to his neighbors' houses while this was happening, and everything was very stressful, and his family was under a lot of pressure and a lot of stress and everything, and having to deal with all of this stuff. And it was incredibly difficult and unfair, and all he wanted to do was his job, and he was saying, you know, I'll do all of the things I'm supposed to do. I'm not going to break my oath. I won't win by cheating. That's unacceptable to Trump, obviously. And similar from Raffensperger, who was just kind of calmly telling Trump, this is not true. The stuff you're saying, there's no evidence for it. I'm not going to make up a number. We don't have any basis that I can just claim that anything's been recalculated and any of that. So after that, second half of that, of hearing number four, we had actually a bit of Raffensperger after the recess, but then two Georgia election workers, or one and her mother who was sitting behind, Wandria Shea Moss, and her mother Ruby Freeman, who likes to be called Lady Ruby, and they are just election workers. They were just people who helped out at the, you know, I don't know if they were volunteers or if it was a job that they did, but they were just doing the job of, you know, counting and helping people to do whatever voting thing they needed to have explained to them and then do and whatever. And they were kind of singled out by Giuliani and others, claiming that they had been essentially committing crimes. And they were then targeted by Trump supporters. They have subsequently sued Giuliani for defamation. That has not come to court yet, but I suspect will do quite well when it does. But their story was heartbreaking. And it was just about people who genuinely are wanting to do their civic duty, wanting to help people vote, wanting to you know, be a part of this democratic process. And they were subjected to abuse by, you know, death threats, racial attacks, and abuse by Trump supporters.
Yeah, and orchestrated or, you know, instigated by Giuliani.
Yeah.
In a kind of... So it is good that he's being held to account for that.
Yeah.
And being sued for defamation because you just can't do. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he thought, he thinks nothing of it.
Yeah, yeah, just, absolutely. And in that hearing, we also heard from Gabe Sterling, who was Deputy Secretary of State in Georgia, who at the time, just after the election, when everything was kicking off, gave a press conference that went a bit viral in the Georgia capital, I guess, equivalent, where he was talking about local election workers who had had death threats and was very emotional and saying, you know, this needs to stop. Everything was fine. Mm. The election was good. We did it all correctly and you just need to stop doing this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so previously that was kind of the story that we'd had about these local election workers and it was from his perspective. And then directly after that, we essentially heard from two actual workers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nice. So the fifth hearing was kind of wild. It was this was the pressure that was put on the Department of Justice.
Yeah.
And largely in the body of Trump wanting to put Jeff Clark in the top job at the DOJ. Because Clark, who was a kind of he's the head of the civil division at the DOJ. So he wasn't a lowly employee, but he was below the Attorney General at the time, the Acting Attorney General, Jeff Rosen, the Deputy Attorney General, Richard Donahue. And certainly in the Civil Division and the Environmental Division, he would not have had anything to do with election law at all.
Yeah.
Eric Hirschman, one of his amusing stories that he relayed about how he'd quipped to the guy, he said, the only things you know about election law and environment law is they both start with E, and based on the answers you've given, I'm not even sure you know that. Richard Donahue said at one point to Jeff Clark, you're an environmental lawyer, go back to your office and we'll call you when there's an oil spill.
Nice.
So they did not think, no one thought, in fact, in this big meeting that they had with Pat Cipollone, Trump's own lawyer, Eric Hirschman, Jeff Rosen, Richard Donahue, Steve Engel, the assistant attorney general for the Office of Legal Counsel, and Jeff Clark. No one thought that Clark was competent to lead the department. And the only reason he would have been given that role and had it taken away from Jeff Rosen was because he's the only person who was prepared to send a letter to various states saying you need to certify different state of electors. Wow. You need to certify electors who are going to say Trump won.
Yeah.
Everyone else in the department was saying this is a lie. It's not based on anything. We're not going to send this letter.
Yeah.
And it got to the point where Trump essentially offered him the job at the head of the DOJ, and the White House call logs were calling him the head of the Attorney General, the Acting Attorney General.
Wow. Wow.
And it was that afternoon, essentially, when he had gone to his boss, Jeff Rosen, and said, by the way, Trump's asked me to do your job instead. And Jeff Rosen said, well, first of all, I'm not going to be fired by a subordinate. I want to speak to the president about this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then they went to the White House. They had an extended meeting where they each said, if you do this, not only is it going to look awful for you, because he's a fucking idiot, we're all going to resign. And not just us, but basically every head of department at the Department of Justice and probably a good section of the US Attorney Generals around the country are going to resign because they won't work for this idiot.
Yeah.
And Stephen Engel, who is an appalling person, he's stood by. I mean, he's been in the Office of Legal Counsel since the beginning, since January 2017, and has authored a number of awful Trump-based opinions that he can do things that he probably shouldn't have been able to do.
Yeah, yeah.
But this is where he drew the line. And Engel told him that not only is everyone going to leave, but the story isn't going to be that the Department of Justice has written to the states to get them to change their states of electors. It's going to be that you fired everyone until you found the one guy who would send this letter.
Who would do it, yes. Yes, yes.
And that's not going to look good for you. And at that point, that was what made Trump go, okay,
all right, fair enough.
I won't.
It will actually come back to me.
Yeah.
Yes, people will associate me with this. Yeah. So there it is. There's another actual active link.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But yeah.
And if it hadn't been for the people at the top of the DOJ saying, we're not doing this, this is unacceptable, it would have taken another step towards the election being overthrown, essentially.
Yeah. It's good that there are outposts of integrity, even if they are on the right wing. But that's, you know, that's...
Yeah,
we dream of that over here in the UK. Those little outposts of integrity. Wow. Yeah.
And then it was at the end of the fifth hearing that we got the list of Republican Congress people who had asked for a presidential pardon. And that list included Mo Brooks, Andy Biggs from Arizona, Louis Gohmert, Scott Perry, and Matt Gaetz. Matt Gaetz, Eric Hirschman said he had asked for a very broad pardon. He'd asked for a pardon from the beginning of time to today for any and all things. Which suggests that Matt Gaetz has a time machine and has done some very fucked up things
with
dinosaurs.
Very fucked up stuff. Yeah. Yes. Exactly.
Cassidy Hutchinson, who we will talk about in a moment, the Mark Meadows White House aide, she said that Matt Gaetz had been asking for a pardon or asking to be included in, you know, suggesting this, blanket pardons, since the beginning of December. And she said, I don't know why, because presumably she doesn't know that he's also being investigated for sex trafficking. It would be very convenient for Matt Gaetz to have got a pardon. He didn't get one, fortunately, but he was he was angling for one very early on in the process, and quite a broad one, please. Just write anything on there that we don't need to specify the particular crimes I may have committed.
Don't need to ask any questions. Just put everything. It's like literally the blank check.
Yeah.
Because, you know, and if someone came to you and asked for that, so, I'm thinking of, you know, extending the presidential pardon for some of these things that I'm really sorry I made you do. And the only way I can kind of keep you free of it, you know, and take the blame myself is if I pardon you and then I will go under the sword. Not that that will ever happen. I'm giving Trump far too much integrity. but for the guy then to put his hand up and go, yeah, can you just take several other 100 million years into account as
just
well?
Don't specify, you know, just stuff in January.
Yeah. And then you kind of... It would give you pause, wouldn't it? It would go, okay, let me think about that.
So after the fifth hearing, the committee said that they were going to postpone the rest of the hearings until July.
Yeah.
Because they had had some new witnesses come forward, more evidence, and they wanted to kind of consolidate it all before they did their summing up and their next hearings. But then today, the 28th, they decided that they were going to have a new surprise hearing just because they had something they really wanted to tell people about.
Right.
It was a new witness, new information had come forward, new evidence.
Yeah.
And it turned out the witness is Cassidy Hutchinson, who is a White House aide. She's the first White House staffer to have testified in the public hearings. We've seen deposition footage of her before. She was deposed several times based on the fact that she was in kind of different locations in various video clips. She was essentially Mark Meadows' assistant when he was chief of staff to Trump.
Yeah.
And among the things that she talked about today were the preparations within the White House for January 6th. Some of the meetings that had come from Giuliani being in the Oval Office and talking about stuff with Mark Meadows. Meadows saying on January 2nd that stuff on January 6th, quote, might get real bad. So
right.
So they knew, you know, to the extent that anyone has claimed, which they have, that it was just a thing, it was a protest that got out of hand and no one knew that it was, you know, what was going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it wasn't something that was planned in advance. It wasn't, you know, they didn't have any coordination with the Proud Boys and all of that stuff. They were well aware, as early as January 2nd, probably earlier,
wow,
what stuff was likely to happen and how bad it might get. Mm. That was the first thing that, when I was watching it, made me sit up and go, ooh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
There was also... the fact that in the speech that Trump gave before the insurrection at the Ellipse, when they were standing in the kind of in the marquee getting ready to go on, he was pissed off about the size of the crowd, which is
right.
Totally on brand.
Yeah.
But the reason the crowd within the Ellipse was not as big as it might otherwise have been was because they had metal detectors. For people who wanted to go into the Ellipse. People could watch the speech from the mall, from further back. Yeah. And that was what a large number of people were choosing to do. They didn't have a capacity problem within the Ellipse. They wanted more people to go in. But when people went in, they were confiscating weapons from them.
Yeah.
They were confiscating. Yeah. They confiscated knives, bear spray, knuckle dusters, various other things.
Yeah.
Batons and things from people who were coming through what they called the mags, the magnetometers or whatever, the metal detectors.
Yeah.
And so basically anyone who wanted to come into the Ellipse could come into the Ellipse, but they had to give up their weapons.
Yeah.
And a large crowd in which the Capitol identified a number of Glocks and AR-15s and other things did not want to come through the metal detectors.
Give them up. Yeah.
At which, when he was informed of this, Trump said he didn't care about the weapons. He said, get rid of the fucking mags. They're not here to hurt me.
Mm.
So he wanted the crowd to be bigger.
Yeah. Yep.
And he didn't care that they were armed because he knew
that they weren't after
him. They weren't after him. They were planning to go somewhere else afterwards.
Yeah.
Well, he said, they're not here for me.
Yes.
They can march to the Capitol from here, he said.
Wow.
So, again, part of the thing that they're trying to do with these hearings is establish the mens rea, the intent that Trump had, his awareness of the shit that was going to happen and his unwillingness to prevent any of it. And I think that goes some way to establishing some of that. They also talked about his desire to go down to the Capitol. Because he said in his speech, we'll march down to the Capitol, I'll be there with you. Initially, I thought that was just big words and he'd never had any intention to do that. But they've spoke to a number of people who said, no, he totally wanted to do it. He'd been trying to get people to let him do it for days.
Wow.
And Pat Cipollone and other White House counsel were warning him against it and saying, no, this opens you up to real liability. You definitely don't want to do it. It's a very bad idea, especially given that at this point they knew the stuff that was probably going to go down. They were saying, you do not want to be there.
Yes.
But even at the point of the speech, when he said, you know, march down to the Capitol after this, I'll be there with you, he was still convinced that he had been able to get his people to agree that he could go down there. So when he got in the Beast, his presidential limo, he thought they were going down to the Capitol.
Oh, wow.
And so when he was told by his security detail that they were going back to the White House, he tried to grab the steering wheel of the Beast.
No shit. Whoa.
And he had to be restrained by a secret service agent who grabbed his arm. who he then physically assaulted in the limo.
Whoa!
This is directly told to Cassidy Hutchinson by that Secret Service agent.
Wow.
So he really wanted to be
he
there.
He really wanted
when,
to go.
When
yeah.
these people were attacking God. The Capitol. But they
wow.
they told him he had to go back to the White House. He said, I'm the fucking president, take me to the Capitol.
Wow.
But they did not.
Wowee.
So some interesting stuff came out in today's
Yeah. yes.
And but, finally, yeah. the last bits that came out were the fact that both Mike Meadows and Rudy Giuliani also asked for pardons.
Mm.
So add them to the list.
Yeah. The ever-growing list. Wow. Bloody hell. I can't believe that. The contretemps in the limo. Wow. Flipping heck. It's great, isn't it? So when is the next episode?
It hasn't been scheduled yet. It will be right. sometime in July. I imagine it'll probably be a couple of weeks.
Right.
Benny Thompson made a kind of plea at the end, essentially saying, you know, look at this woman here, Cassidy Hutchinson. Look yeah. how brave she's been in standing up for
yeah.
what, you know, her civic duty is and yeah. saying all this stuff, knowing, he implied, he didn't say this, but knowing that she's inevitably going to get a lot of shit for it. You know, if this has jogged the memory of anyone who has claimed right. they don't remember stuff to us
yeah.
before, or made you find some courage somewhere, our door is open. Come and talk to us.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there's, yeah, they've had people who have essentially pled the fifth, or claimed they don't remember stuff, or refused to talk to them. Liz Cheney at the end showed a couple of messages from people, because they asked the witnesses, has anyone talked to you about your testimony today and has
right.
tried to influence you in any way?
Yeah, yeah.
And she showed a couple of the things that people have answered to that, which is essentially yes. People have kind of talked to them and said, you know, remember that these, you know, people are watching these. They know if you're loyal, you know, if you do the right thing, if you say the right thing, you'll yeah. be treated well and that kind of stuff. And essentially witness tampering. And so, yeah, they are trying to use these hearings to not only, as we've said, tell the story to the people and to yeah. the DOJ, but also to encourage people with any other information to come forward. And I think that seems like what happened with Cassidy Hutchinson. You know, she gave her depositions. I imagine that after the first four or five hearings, she contacted them and said, I'm prepared to speak publicly. You know, I'm prepared to
wow.
be deposed, be
brand new stuff. Yeah, yeah. Wow. And finally, some things we really don't have time to talk about.
To be honest, it's been a pretty shitty month for fundamental rights. The Supreme Court tried Trump's tactic of doing so many awful things at once that nobody can possibly pay attention to all of them. So in their last 2 weeks of term, the Supreme Court ruled that certain federal agents can assault you and there's not much you can do about it, that taxpayers in Maine have to fund private Christian schools because of religious freedom, that public school teachers can now lead their students in prayer during school events, and that being informed of your right to remain silent and your right to an attorney isn't all that important after all. Also, they decided that gun control is too important for states to decide, and then one day later decided that states deciding who gets the right to an abortion is the only logical option. So, if you have an unwanted pregnancy, the court's view is that you have to have the baby, but thanks to a complete lack of gun control, the problem will work itself out by the time the kid gets to elementary school.
Yeah.
I think yeah. I have a solution, though. All we have to do is come up with a method of abortion that involves shooting the fetus with a tiny AR-15, and I'm pretty sure Republicans will be on board. Arguably, the GOP is now over-delivering on Sarah Huckabee Sanders' pledge last month when she said, quote, we will make sure that when a kid is in the womb, they're as safe as they are in a classroom.
Mm.
She said that, by the way, on the day of the Uvalde school shooting. But it wasn't just unfortunate timing / depressingly inevitable that there happened to be a school shooting on the day she said it. The shooting happened first, hours before Sanders decided classrooms were the best example of a safe space for tiny humans.
So, we all watched the second series of Picard, didn't we? A grand time-travelling psychodrama of operatic proportions with the much-celebrated return of Q, who reappeared while facing his own demise to bring about huge changes on behalf of a floundering Arizona congressional candidate called Ron Watkins. Wait a minute. Life, as ever, has a habit of emulating art. I hesitate to say the word real, but the real Q we know about through QAnon conspiracy theory, which everyone, of course, denies, because where's the arrest of Hillary, Biden, all the paedophile ring within Hollywood, resurrection of John F. Kennedy, etc., etc.? Oh, look, nowhere. Yeah, better keep a distance from all that shiz. Well, he's back. Big whoops of directionless sheep-like joy when Q dropped a post saying, "Let's play a game," back on 8kun the other day, followed by "lols, soz, had to be done this way, BTW." Well, yeah, my tech slang I added for deprecating effects. When everyone said, "Where you been? We need you." To do exactly what is unclear. However, fellow 4chan, 8chan, 8kun, Q psychodrama actor Frederick Brennan thinks something's a bit off, because the trip codes Q used to identify that he was the same guy posting, though anonymously, appeared again after 2 years, despite 8kun administrator Ron Watkins, yep, him, the congressional wannabe, said those codes change automatically every month. So Fred knows it's Ron. We know it's Ron. His dad, Jim, denies it's Jim because he was giving a speech on Truth Tour, and who are we to doubt that? So, yeah, it's Ron, always was. He's doing the reverse of John Eastman and actually is using himself to incriminate himself less than 40 days before the Arizona primary. Because when he's posted the same stuff as Q, as plain old Ron, no one listened. Look, unless you're the Borg Queen melded with a geeky AI scientist, Ron, no one gives a shit about what you have to say, and who'll believe you if you say you were Q all along? You're really going to need to use the Picard manoeuvre after all.
We've talked before about the many lies Georgia GOP Senate candidate and former Heisman Trophy winner Herschel Walker has told on the campaign trail. This month, you can add claiming he was a member of law enforcement in Cobb County, a claim the Cobb County Police Department has denied. It's no surprise that these lies have had little impact on the Republican voter base, since honestly, they seem to prefer being lied to. It's almost a fetish for them at this point. Even the fact that he seems to think there are 52 states, since he suggested that if Stacey Abrams doesn't like it in Georgia, there are 51 other states she could move to, doesn't make a dent in his electability. The weird thing is his popularity among religious folk, even though he's running against a literal Christian pastor. Walker spoke at the Faith and Freedom Coalition the day before Father's Day at the end of a week of revelations about the three secret children he had had out of wedlock in different relationships, one of whom he only supports financially because their mother sued him for child support. The good Christians at the Faith and Freedom Coalition apparently don't mind a bit of hypocrisy either, since Walker regularly rebukes black men in general for creating fatherless homes by abandoning their children. Of course, to anyone who's been paying attention for the last 2,000 years, it's not actually surprising the conservative Christians value the conservatism more than the Christianity, and that's why conference attendee Paulina McFoy claims Walker is a good candidate because he, quote, stands for family, and Faith and Freedom founder Ralph Reed said, "I've never seen a candidate that open about his faith." Again, he's running against a literal Christian pastor.
Not happy with banning books, calling teachers paedophile groomers, and likening equal rights for the LGBTQ plus community as the end of civilization as they know it. Right-wing commentators, of course, are having a go at Pixar's Lightyear now. Paris Hilton tweeted as a reminder to all sentient beings watching the film that Lightyear is banned in multiple countries over a gay kiss. Cartoons kissing, y'all. That's some commitment to homophobia. Well, never one's to balk at looking fascistically committed in the name of suppression of anyone's rights but their own, talk radio host Larry O'Connor responded that Disney has decided to warp its credibility with parents everywhere by letting us know that even its cartoons are no longer free from content that might be objectionable. Yeah, keep up, Larry. Where you been? Disney decided in the 50s that Donald Duck could walk around bottomless whilst Mickey had to wear pants. And it was fine for a man to make a boy out of wood and take it on biblically flavoured whale gullet adventures. More self-incriminating irony from American conservatives Ron Dreher, who accused Disney of appeasing the woke mob that wants to sexualize children and trying to turn popular art into culture war propaganda, when he's doing exactly that. Emmett Paley, the CEO of the Trevor Project, an LGBTQ plus youth advocacy organisation, warns that the resurgence of regressive anti-LGBTQ attacks that seek to smear adults, including parents, teachers, counsellors and doctors who affirm and support LGBTQ youth, is incredibly dangerous and diverts attention away from the critical work being done to prevent and address actual child abuse and sexual assault perpetrated against LGBTQ youth. But hey, conservatives don't care as long as they get all the rights and everyone else gets none, so they can stay in power and not have to listen to actual public opinion to infinity and beyond.
Back in episode 96, we talked a bit about Tina Peters, the county elections clerk who committed 7 felonies and 3 misdemeanors in an attempt to prove how easy it is to get away with election tampering by copying and then publishing the contents of voting machine hard drives. Incidentally, as we record this episode, people are voting on whether to make Tina the Republican candidate for Secretary of State for Colorado. Thanks to some New York Times reporting this week, Ms. Peters has now been linked to 2 other prominent election conspiracy theorists. It seems her legal defence is being paid for by friend of the show and Mario after he's eaten a rotten mushroom, Mike Lindell. That relationship has been public for a while now. She even appeared on stage at Lindell's cyber symposium, in which he proved once and for all that not one of the cyber experts he paid millions of dollars to knows what a packet capture actually is. The revelation in the Times article, though, was that Miss Peters also knows Colorado Congresswoman Lauren Boebert. In fact, she claims it was Boebert who encouraged her to go forward with the scheme to image the machine's hard drive. Lauren is also in a primary race today, where the polls close in about an hour. But win or lose, it sounds like she might get to add accessory before the fact to her already impressive rap sheet.
Nice. For a man who upholsters sleep, fat comedy Rupert Pupkin, Mike Lindell, just can't keep quiet. Anyone would think he's running for office or courting the popular vote or something. Why else would he have no qualms about committing the old reductio ad Hitlerum fallacy? Walmart has decided from now on to only sell Mike's Mike pillows online and no longer in store. This, of course, according to Lindell, is cancel culture gone mad, likening himself to everyone who had their right-wing conspiracy-riddled accounts on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, etc. blocked on January 7th, you know, after the attempted coup by Trump's acolytes. He said, "This is like Nazi Germany," but expanded no further as to why. Incensed that his overpriced, overstuffed Bonce cushions would not be carried in store, he declared that they were Walmart's biggest product, the biggest of all time, again, citation required, and got so angry after the Zoom call with Walmart informing of their decision that he shut the computer. Jesus, Walmart, be careful. Still, they have retail colleagues to help them over the trauma. Costco pulled MyPillow's products, as did Bed Bath & Beyond, QVC, JCPenney and Wayfair. In February, Lindell also told Insider one of his banks had cut ties with him, citing him as a reputation risk. Open your eyes, Mikey. Can't you see when you're in bed with the likes of Trump peddling his nightmare election bull batshittery? Is it any wonder no one wants to wake up with your horsey head in their bed?
I have to admit, when I heard Rudy Giuliani got slapped in a Staten Island supermarket, I was pretty excited. I was picturing a Will Smithian attack, and then I found out there was video of the incident. It's a great angle too. It unmistakably shows the ShopRite employee walking up to Rudy and patting him lightly on the back, as if America's mayor was choking on a pretzel and this guy wanted to be able to say he'd tried, but didn't want to hit him hard enough that the pretzel would actually dislodge and then he'd have to live with the fact that he'd saved Rudy's life. It's the kind of careful pat on the back you'd use to burp a baby who is particularly prone to throwing up all over you. Of course, that's not how Rudy described it all before he knew there was a video.
And all of a sudden, I feel a shot on my back, like somebody shot me. I went forward, but luckily I didn't fall down. Lucky I'm a 78-year-old in pretty good shape, because if I wasn't, I'd have hit the ground and probably cracked my skull.
you can't blame Rudy. He's never experienced a pat on the back before because he's never done anything to deserve one. But given how wildly inaccurate his account of this incident was, I'm beginning to doubt his election fraud claims. But in case you think Rudy reached the limits of exaggeration, that honour goes to the Twitter account Republicans for National Renewal, who tweeted, "This was an assassination attempt on a great patriot by a radical leftist terrorist."
Wow.
I really wish I could tell you this is a parody account, but unless they've been really fucking deep cover for over a couple of years as a 501c3 that hosts events at CPAC, this is real. I'm still not completely ruling it out, since they did manage to misspell Merry Christmas on a poster advertising their Christmas party last year.
Sending messages. In miserable, cut-off, xenophobic, slowly disintegrating, strike-bound, energy-poor, fat-cat-rich, increasingly irrelevant blighty this week, Boris underwent routine nasal surgery. Presumably Geppetto hacked the usual 15-foot extension of mistruth-based proboscis off his face again. Apart from lying about trying to get his then-girlfriend Carrie a job in government or the royal family, or lying about encouraging pay restraint and then okaying a removal of pay caps for bankers, the Tories lied about how it didn't matter that they lost two by-elections, one of which Boris was at great Trump-like pains to say they'd won with a big majority only the year before. Like that counts. Devoted folks in his party had voted that they had every confidence in him in the vote of no confidence he survived last week, expressed feigned surprise and buyer's remorse, and either resigned or, true to form, looked to change the rules so they could have another go at ousting him. Unabashed, Boris talked of undergoing no psychological shift, ignoring anyone whose opinions he didn't like, including the voters in Wakefield and Honiton and Tiverton, and indeed spoke of his plans of a third term in office, whilst standing on the beach, commanding the tide to go back. Meanwhile, determined to refocus the nation's Boris weaponised nostalgia away from Vera Lynn, White Cliffs, Ricketts, diphtheria and white supremacists, sorry, the Queen's platitudes, Sir Paul McCartney reminded the world of all the good things born in the 60s, well, other than the current government, that is, by playing a three-hour set at Glastonbury consisting of every single song everyone innately knows the words to ever, all of which were written by him. If you find yourself in times of trouble, remember Stormzy came to we, speaking words of wisdom. Fuck Boris.
So that's all the bad arguments and faulty reasoning we have time for this week. You'll find the show notes at fallacioustrump.com, and if you hear Trump say something stupid and want to ask if it's a fallacy, our contact details are on the contact page.
If you think we've used a fallacy ourselves, let us know. If you had a good time, please give us a review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts, or simply tell one other person in person about how much they'd like our podcast. And you can support the show at patreon.com/ftrump. Just like our strawman level patrons Steve Bickle, Schmutz, Mark Reiki, and Abba R. Buchanan, and our true Scotsman level patrons Kaz Tui, Andrew Houck, Max Beaver, and our top patron Lauren. Thanks very much for your patronage, everyone. It really is very much appreciated.
You can connect with those awesome people as well as us and other listeners in the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/fallacioustrump.
All music is by The Outbursts and was used with permission. So until next time on Fallacious Trump, we'll leave the last word to the Donald.
That's right. Go home to mommy. Bye. Bye.